Welcome to Season 6 of the Be Conscious Podcast, where we continue our interviews and conversations on the human constructs prevailing on Earth at present. Today, I am joined by Dr. Jose Pimiente Bay, tenured professor of African and African-American Studies at Breyer College in Kentucky. Dr. Bay will lead us in an insightful and intriguing discussion on world religions. Here we go.
Welcome to the Be Conscious Podcast, the show that brings you enlightened perspectives on the frequency of money, life's many challenges, and those heavy feelings that may be holding you back from living your best life. And now your host, Dr. Susan Nicholas.
Dr. Pimiente Bay is a tenured associate professor of African and African-American Studies and General Studies at Breyer College in Kentucky. For the past 17 years, he has taught courses within the African-American, General Studies, History, and Psychology departments. Dr. Bay's primary research interests include Moorish history, Black psychology, comparative religious studies, and African-American social and political thought. Dr. Bay is a distinguished and decorated author of numerous articles, essays, books, and chapters. Dr. Bay, welcome to the Be Conscious Podcast.
Thank you, Dr. Nicholas. Thank you. I appreciate being invited here.
Well, Jose, I am doing a series for Season 6 of the Be Conscious Podcast on what I consider worldly constructs. They are prevailing ideologies and thoughts that are prevailing on the planet today. Mm-hmm. And one of the big ones that I think these are constructs, ideologies, programs that we are all born into. One is obviously the religious construct. And in the world today, we've identified primary religious kind of thoughts or theologies. Mm-hmm. And I would say for many people, we're not sitting very well with these prevailing constructs of religion. There's, mm-hmm. There's a lot of, strife and contentiousness with religion, institutional mm-hmm. religions. Now, before we get into kind of the constructs of religion on the earth, can you share with us your background, how you came into studying religions and writing about them and teaching about them?
Yes. For me, I'd have to say the first time that I really noticed that I had an interest in the various expressions of spiritual understanding, or, even if we started by saying, well, what does that mean when one uses the term, religion, to return to something, to return to the law, to return to spiritual law, or the study of the unknown, or the study of God, or the study of spirituality, right? Like many of us born, of course, within the United States, and particularly with my background in terms of my parentage, I was born into a family that was primarily rooted in Christianity, and then secondarily in a very unique understanding of Islam that is associated with things like Sufism, the Marabout traditions, even Gnosticism, which is an expression of Christian mysticism. And so probably 17, 18 years old, talking with my uncle, Johnny, who, again, came out of a Christian tradition. In fact, he was raised as an Anglican, but came to understand something known as Moorish science. And the Moorish Science Temple, which represents an organization established in the early 20th century by a man named Timothy Noble Drew Ali, who had this, what many people in terms of scholars have deemed a rather eclectic understanding of religion, and more specifically, a rather eclectic understanding of what is known as Islam, or the submission to the will of Allah or God, right? One who submits to the will of God. And then, of course, the next question is, who or what is God? So having those conversations at a rather young age, like I said, 17, 18 years old, with my uncle about religion. And in particular, he had a very unique take on Christianity, aspects of which were not very favorable because of how it was being expressed. Very often, even now I'll have students in one of my introduction to History of Christianity courses, which is called Understandings of Christianity, will actually state, rather overtly that they have no appreciation for religion or religions. And then as you dig a little deeper, I find out what they're saying is they have no real appreciation for Christianity. Mm. But their assumption is that Christianity is religion, period. There's a lack of awareness of the vastness of religious expression or spiritual expression. So that's the first thing. And then I'll even kind of get them to say more about what it is that they dislike. And very often what they dislike are either the actions of people who were professing to be Christians or certain aspects of biblical scripture, which they disagree with. And then they'll say that they kind of just throw the whole thing out, mm-hmm. the old saying, throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Exactly.
So just to wrap up real quickly. So my initial, I guess the catalyst for my interest came from these conversations with my Uncle Johnny, and then became greater as I went on to undergrad and had a course with a comparative religious professor, and then a professor of Indian civilization, as in India, as in Hinduism.
Mm. So I know I'm going to ask you a very big question, but I have a feeling that you can distill this down for us in a meaningful way. Since you are a comparative religious professor, someone who has studied this with great interest and dedication, can you help us to understand the history, just a very brief history of Christianity, maybe in comparing that to mm-hmm. Islam, or in comparing that to perhaps Judaism? My thoughts are that foundationally they're all connected.
Mm-hmm.
And we have found different ways of separating and differentiating ourselves in ways too numerous to count.
Mm-hmm.
Just from genuflections, how we move our bodies or where or how we pray and whatnot. But can you help us just set the foundation for the world religions today?
Okay. Well, when we say the world religions, again, like I said, with the idea of trying to discuss the world religions, right, in terms of what that actually means, would essentially be impossible, even if we did a workshop for a week, mm-hmm. only because there are so many religious expressions that we may not even know about. And then there are interpretations of the mainstream or major world religions. So just for clarity, what we're really talking about, and, by virtue of what you just, asked, the Judeo-Christian Islamic religions, those three, are understood to come from the same source. They're rooted in Judaism. They're rooted in the revelation of Abraham or Ibrahim. It's understood that this particular religious figure or prophet is believed to have lived around 1700 BCE, coming from part of the world that is today in Iraq and Kuwait, and who would then establish the monotheistic tradition of Judaism that would then be extended, if you will, by various prophets, including Moses or Musa, again, historically framed about 1200 BC, and then coming down to the man known as the Christ, Jesus the Christ, or in Arabic as Isa, a prophet, who then conveys, if you will, an extended understanding of that earlier monotheistic tradition that is attributed to Abraham or Ibrahim. All three of those religions are generally referred to, therefore, as monotheistic religions. Within those three religions, in fact, the reason why, you know, if you will, Islam exists and comes into being as its own defined religious expression in the 7th century of the Common Era is because it's understood that the Arab prophet, Muhammad, peace be upon him, and all prophets, essentially was trying to clarify, trying to correct misrepresentations of earlier understandings of monotheism that existed both in the context of Judaism and also in the context of Christianity. And ironically, even in the religion of al-Islam or Islam, there is a love and respect for Jesus or Isa, who is very significant in the context even of the Muslim world. And then in the context, of course, of Judaism, again, which has various sects, people will talk about the Orthodox communities or the Reformed communities, and they have different understandings of how to interpret the Most High God or Yahweh or Jehovah. And so there's great diversity there, but essentially they're waiting for a Messiah or Mashiach to come, whereas Christians, of course, are saying that he's already come. That was the man known as Jesus the Christ or known as Jesus or Isa. And then the Muslim community would say that Jesus was a prophet, and there was going to be another prophet after Jesus, and that prophet was Muhammad. And again, peace be upon Jesus, peace be upon Moses, Musa, Ibrahim, and Muhammad, all prophets. So that's the concept in terms of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, the major, what are considered the three major religions. But we have to keep in mind, and this is what's often missed, Hinduism, right? Which, you know, the vast majority of the peoples of India, the second largest population, single population on the planet is in India. Hinduism is also religion, and therefore one has to look to things like the Vedas or understand the accounts that relate to Krishna, Arjuna, or Rama, and other expressions of deity that exist within the Indus Valley. And then last and not least, traditional African religions, or ATR, too numerous to mention, but the one that I'm a bit more familiar with would be like the Yoruba, primarily within Nigeria, right? So, and then I could of course, talk about Buddhism, and Buddhism, which is attributed, of course, to Siddhartha, the Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, who essentially is born in Nepal sometime, and I'm forgetting the exact date, but the 5th century BC, and introduces a new understanding of spiritual expression, which places emphasis upon meditation and trying to achieve a certain level of enlightenment. People will often reference the Dharma, which are the Buddhist teachings, things like kindness and virtue and generosity, compassion, wisdom, all being important things for humanity to attain. And Buddhism, which is also emphasizing this idea of trying to mediate suffering, which is understood to be a part of our existence. You can't avoid it. Mm-hmm. But what you can do is learn how to mitigate it. So again, I'm just trying to give an overview of some of the primary expressions of what we would define as the, you know, the various religions of the world, of this world.
Yes. You know, I really appreciate that overview. And I know I asked you an impossible question. So this takes me back to something that you said very early on about kind of spirituality or right. spiritualism and religion. And I think myself and many others who were born into heavy religious constructs, like I was born into the Christianity construct and mm-hmm. further divided into the Baptist mm-hmm. Kind of stuff. When I think of that type of, I call it institutional religion because it's quite rigid. You know, the beliefs are this, and if you're not, you know, there's a lot of exclusion and a lot of rules and things like that. And so I feel like they're very rigid constructs. But when you say things like Buddhism, I think of that more as spirituality. Like to me, there's a link or there's related, but they're different. Mm-hmm. In my experience on the planet. Right. And so when I think of like Buddhism or I think of prophets like the Buddha or Siddhartha or Lao Tzu or the Tao Te Ching, or, you know, when I think of stuff like that, I'm like, oh, that's not religion. That's spirituality. That's about wholeness and connectedness. And once when I think of Rama, even in the Hindu, I'm not suggesting that I know the ins and outs of it, but when I think of them or how I perceive them is more spiritual and less religious. Where mm-hmm. religious, you know, like there's the doctrine and the book and the way and the kind of like the rod and the shaft, you know, like almost like you're beaten into submission of religion, where spirituality is more of my experience, like an experience of yourself, like experiencing the wholeness and the expanse of yourself. Do I have this thinking? How do you perceive that?
Well, I think, I'm glad you shared that with me, Susan, because what it essentially, at least for me, proves is that there is a general misconception of what religion means. That the Judeo-Christian Islamic understanding of spirituality has kind of circumvented or gotten control over the whole definition of what constitutes a religion, because religion can essentially just, you know, mean a specific system of worship, belief, and it often involves a code of ethics. Well, that's Buddhism. That's Hinduism, right? But I think what you're expressing is that once Christianity, which is, of course, a very dominant religion, by dominant, I mean, you know, in terms of the last several centuries, the Judeo-Christian faith has taken dominance or precedence over most other understandings of spiritual expression. so that when people think religion, they think of Christianity or Judaism or perhaps Islam. But again, religion is this code of ethics with a spiritual emphasis, because, I mean, all religions are essentially attempts to put into context something which is transcendent, meaning it's above our existence. And it's this idea of the thoughts, the beliefs, the practices that are concerned with trying to grasp the transcendent and the ultimate questions of life, right? The mysteries of life. So the spirituality aspect, and people say, well, I'm not religious, I'm spiritual. Mm-hmm. What they're actually illustrating is that they've fallen victim to the idea that the term religion can only encompass the monotheistic traditions, right? Because the word religion shouldn't only encompass the monotheistic traditions. The idea of a kind of new, you know, the term, of course, that would come into play in the 20th century, the idea of, you know, the new age thinking and, you know, people saying that they're spiritual, is based upon this idea of the institutionalized religions that become most dominant, right? Judeo-Christian, Islamic, spiritual understandings, then compelling most people to only think of those three, you could say the big three, when they think of the term religion. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, strictly speaking, it doesn't, because again, I just, even when in the context, like I said, of African spiritual teachings, people talk about traditional African religions, or the acronym is ATR, which means African traditional religions. People like John Mbiti, who was a prominent Kenyan theologian, wrote extensively about African traditional religions, from the Yoruba to the Ibu to the Maasai to the Zulu to the Khoisan, and on, right? I mean, we're talking about hundreds of ethnic groups on the continent who then have a particular understanding of spirituality that has some common denominators. There are common factors among those, things like ancestor veneration and things like reincarnation, respect for nature, even the recognition that there's a supreme being, but that supreme being, like in the case of the Yoruba, would be Olodumare. But even in the case of a supreme being, there are attributes or expressions of that being via other gods and goddesses. Mm-hmm. So I just want to, like I said, bring it back to not falling victim to the idea that the term religion should only encompass the monotheistic traditions of the West, right? Mm. That's the trap.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think when it comes to religiosity or faith or whatnot, there are several triggering words. Mm-hmm. And I think religion is one of them. Mm-hmm. Because of all, like you said earlier, all the actions of those professing to be leaders in those religions.
Right.
Or perhaps their code of ethics is so strict that it's exclusionary. There's a lot of rhetoric, mm-hmm, that it's not all inclusive. And so I think, I don't know if it's, mm-hmm, people like me or people like your students or just the general population that are having, that the issue lies with them of only relating religion to the monotheistic.
You call them the big three, the monotheistic, right? The Judaism,
the big three,
Christianity, and Islam. Yeah, the big.
But I think it's what's happening inside of them. Like, you know, for instance, like we see wars in the name of these big, mm-hmm, three, mm-hmm, and so you're thinking, okay, why, if this is about love and harmony and peace, and why are we fighting about it? Why is it threatening if I don't believe all of it, or if I don't, you know, if I don't subscribe to the whole shebang, like I don't just take it spoon fed to me without asking any questions, without thinking?
That's an excellent question you're asking. Yes.
Yes, I do think that each individual has a responsibility in their own, as you said, understandings, perceptions, belief systems. But I think our experiences are informed by the actions committed in these big three. Mm-hmm. That it's almost like we are infected with it. So when I say that, it's like we're all born into this very dense earth milieu. Mm-hmm. And it's full of constructs, it's full of programs, conditions, belief systems. Mm-hmm. And so it's like we can't escape it. And so what we do is we are born into families, we're born into communities, societies, where this is the prevailing construct, where, you know, depending on what part of the world I'm born in, then I'm infected with it. It is infused in my ethos or my ideology of life. Mm-hmm. And then I decide at some point in my life that it's not including me, right? Like there's something about it, or many things, that maybe actually even harm me. Mm. And so I feel like the only way out, or the only way to almost heal myself or to be free as a being of light, mm-hmm. is to reject the construct. Mm. Because within it, I cannot be free. You know, I cannot be whole. I cannot be connected to all of it. Like if I'm a part of one of the big three, then I'm almost have to reject another, because my personal, or where I grew up, rejects the other and says, oh, if you believe this, then you're going to hell or something, you know, or if you don't follow my way, it's like, there's not.
Yeah.
There's this perpetuation of the way.
Right. And would you say that here's the psychological aspect of that. One could argue that we're looking at the imposition of the dogma for the purpose of control, right? Certain mm-hmm. institutions are saying, or have said historically, we need to control this particular people, or this particular nation, or this particular mm-hmm. group. And if we can construct something that does so under the auspices of religion, right, or spirituality, if I can get you to buy into this idea, mm-hmm. that if you do this, the consequences are, as you pointed out, you're going to hell. You've angered God, right? And then the next question should be, well, what things are these religions saying you shouldn't do, right? Mm-hmm. And what are the consequences of those things? See, it is safe to say that all religions, and again, I'm going beyond the big three, all religions have a purpose of trying to get their adherents to conform to a particular set of values, right? A particular set of values. So if one was to summarize, you know, Christianity to some extent, and even Judaism to some extent, people often refer to the Ten Commandments. Mm-hmm. Right? Ironically, the Ten Commandments look a lot like what was known as the negative confessions in ancient Egypt, which were more than 10. Mm-hmm. So significantly more. And in the case of these ancient Egyptian writings, which are over 4,000 years old, they said things like, I have not polluted the water. I have not taken food from the mouth of a babe, of a child, right? In addition to things like, I have not taken the life of an innocent person. Right. But you see how in the context of ancient Egypt, their religious expression, their religion, if you will, was emphasizing this ecological sensibility, this environmentalist sensibility that we don't tend to see in more contemporary expressions of the big three. Right. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that there's anything automatically wrong about a set of values that are intended to have a particular community work together, work in tandem, right? Again, even in the context of ancient Egypt, when people talked about the self-mastered person or the Geru Ma'a, they were essentially saying this was the person who became one guided by things like justice and harmony and order and compassion, and that these sort of ethical values were intended to make for a more harmonious society, right? If you have no ethical structure in place, then obviously you are going to have significant problems. The question is, right, what are those ethics? What were certain institutions trying to prevent people from doing? And that's where discussions, say, about patriarchy come into play. Like, you know, why does it certainly appears that women were often so limited in their power in the context of the big three again? And were there religious expressions to the contrary, or had women in positions of greater authority? And can you even find that, for example, in manifestations of the big three? Or are we then looking at other religious expressions that involve, goddess worship? Ironically, even in the context, again, of ancient Egypt, when one talked about Osset, also known as from the Greek as Isis, the queen of heaven, right? Isis, who was, you could say, part of the proverbial trinity of ancient Egyptian religious belief, with Isis, Horus, and Osiris. And so that feminine principle, that feminine energy, that feminine power was contained in those teachings. And it'll find expression in other places at other times. So, but I think, just to kind of wrap up this point, I would argue that the reason why we often think this way about these religious expressions, and I know you referenced, you said, having been raised within the Christian construct with a specific emphasis upon, say, the Baptist denomination, right? And of course, there are multiple denominations. And of course, the Baptists, like the Presbyterians or like the Lutherans, Methodists, are all known as Protestants, Protestants, protest, the key word being protest. Hmm. These were Christian communities that essentially had protested against the way that the teachings of the Christ were being expressed in the Roman Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. So those who protested against the Roman Catholic Church, which of course is the foundation really for the institution known as Christianity to a large extent. I mean, although one can then reference the Orthodox churches of the East, but the idea that those communities following people like John Huss, and then the culmination of these protesters being Martin Luther, right? Martin Luther, who was the one that really triggers what's known as the Reformation. And it was because they looked at, including Martin Luther, although not to the greatest extent that many people would say he should have, and I know in the context of 21st century thinking, folks would say, well, Luther didn't go far enough. But in the context of his time, right, in the context of his time, some 500 you know, years ago. This, or greater, this is someone who was challenging the dogma of the Roman Catholic Church, and as a result, broke that monopoly on the teachings of, or teachings associated with the Christ. But then, unfortunately, these other denominations or sects that would break from or fragment from the Roman Catholic Church would then become dogmatic themselves, so that you would then see persecution by a particular denomination of other denominations. Which leads to this question, and this goes back to your point, why? Why was it so necessary to compel everyone to believe exactly as somebody else believed? Well, it's because they often had another agenda. Yes, these religious communities then became empowered, and they then became linked to the powerful, and the powerful wanted to maintain that oligarchical structure. And anybody who had a diverse understanding was going to end up potentially being an enemy of whatever new organization, church, religion manifests. That's true in Islam, when one talks about the Sunni versus the Shia, and then there's even the Karahites, and then there are the Druzi. I mean, there are different sects, right? And then in the context, even of Buddhism, although Buddhism doesn't have the same reputation, for example, of warmongering, because when people will look at the religious wars that occur in Europe following the before and following the Reformation, right? Even going back to something known as the Great Schism in the 11th century, we had Christians killing other Christians, you know, to take what these other Christians had. And that was a conflict between the Roman Catholic and what will become the Orthodox churches. And the question is, why would believers in Jesus, the Prince of Peace, be killing each other in the name of the Prince of Peace? Right? It doesn't make any sense.
Right.
It only makes sense if one recognizes that religion or the teachings become an excuse by the oligarchs. It's an excuse for going in and taking other people's stuff or taking other people's lives in the hope that no one will rebel, because if they do, their own immortal souls would be lost. In fact, that's a key factor. I'll make this really quick. One needs to understand that in the context of the Roman Catholic Church, in individuals, I'm not talking about so much in 2022. This is clearly the case in 1222, 1422, 1722, you know, 1922, right?
The 2022.
Church, right. And I had mentioned that yet as well, right? That is this. Your salvation was not in your hands. Your salvation was in the hands of the church. So that was kind of held over the heads of the people who were part of the church in those earlier centuries, right? Where if you don't do as we say, meaning the bishop, the cardinal, the pope, the priest, we will basically pull the rug out from under you, and you will end up at best in purgatory and at worst in hell. Regardless of whether you're a good person, I don't care whether you're a good man or a good woman, their view was you have to be in good standing with the church. That's a lot of power if you can convince people that you have no spiritual access to your own salvation, that another institution holds that. And any Christians that had a diverse view, even at the beginning, within the first century, for example, of shortly after Christ and during the time of Paul and after Paul, groups like the Gnostics, for example, rejected that. And they said our salvation is in our own hands. Jesus gave us the tools or showed us the way to attain that. No institution holds control over my soul or my destiny, which was seen as a threat to the dogmatic institutions for over a millennia.
I think it still is a threat, this idea that you hold the keys to your own salvation, your own spirit. Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Bay, I'm going to take a short break, and then we're going to shift the conversation just slightly, because you mentioned something about the patriarchy, and you talked mm-hmm. about control and an agenda, and really the suppression of the divine feminine. Stay with us.
Like what you're hearing so far, make sure you never miss a show by clicking the subscribe button now. How would you describe your relationship with money? Did you ever imagine that your deepest feelings and beliefs about money could be preventing you from acquiring all the wealth that you desire? Click the link below in the show notes to learn more about Dr. Nicholas's highly sought-after Frequency of Money program to positively transform your relationship with money. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Now, back to the show.
So, Jose, before we took that short break, you began discussing with us the purported agenda of the mm-hmm. big three. And you said something that struck me about control. And the question that came up for me is, what is everybody so afraid of? Mm-hmm. Why would you need to control my spirituality, my beliefs in myself? I understand the idea, just generally speaking, that there are some codes of ethics for living on the planet in harmony with each other, with the animals, the plants, with the whole planet. I get mm-hmm. that. I get that. I don't think anyone would say, oh, no. We're just going to, you know, wreak havoc on the world. I mean, maybe some people, but you know what I mean? Generally, I think you could get consensus that there is some sort of foundational manner of existing on the planet. Okay. So we get that. I think many would not argue that. So what is the agenda? Like, why you talked about these very powerful feminine figures in religious history and world history. Mm-hmm. Why would you say in the big three that there is a suppression of the presence of the activity of the power of the woman? Because to me, it sounds like the religious institutions as they are today and as they've stood for millennia are disempowering to individuals. So, or to parishioners or to believers. The idea that because I give myself a title as the leader of a institution, organization that's tied with money, like you said, and the powerful, that somehow I self declare that I actually have dominion over your soul, and that only through me can you make this ascension, you know, transcend the suffering, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. So to me, it is a power play. And the idea is that the billions upon billions of believers and parishioners of every sect of every denomination are disempowered, and the power lies within the leaders of those institutions. I understand the idea, if I'm the leader and I want power and money and whatever power looks like of the ages, whatever that means for different times, for different people, that if I'm the self-declared, I don't know, leader, then I would want more power. Maybe it just comes from this energy of greed or being infatuated with power. And so in order to do that, I think what the root of this is I instill fear in the believer. I make them afraid that if they do not yield to my will, my power, my ideology, my institution, my ethos, mm-hmm. I mean, suffering on earth is not enough, right? You're going to suffer after.
Right.
And so the idea is, to me, the root of it is invoking fear, mm-hmm. or perpetuating fear.
For the purpose of control, right?
Yes, for the purpose of control, perpetuating fear among all believers.
Mm-hmm. And so, just to be clear, you're asking me, why do I think that there is this legacy, historical legacy of
control.
Control.
And what's the agenda?
What's the agenda? Right.
Mm-hmm.
Again, being as clear as I can, I can only speak in a very limited way about religions, plural, for what I stated at the top, of course, mm-hmm. of our interview.
Mm-hmm. I understand.
Since a lot of this is coming back to Judaism, Christianity, Islam, the big three, the monotheistic traditions, which has the biggest expression and probably is what is most widely known and felt by the majority of peoples on the earth. And that's a consequence of certain historical events, right? There are several historians and theologians who, for example, point out how, to a large degree, what becomes the Roman Catholic Church is a renewed expression of the old Roman Empire, right? And so the old Roman Empire, as it collapses, the pieces that are pulled together and used to create what will become the Roman Catholic Church, and the direct involvement of former Roman officials, emperors like Constantine,
mm-hmm.
who was largely responsible for calling together what's called the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD. And this was to a large degree, also done to quell diverse understandings of the teachings of the Christ. Because you had people in Egypt, mm-hmm. people in North Africa, like Arius, who would establish what would be known as the Arian Church, not to be confused with Arian. One thinks about white supremacists, for example, mm-hmm. A-R-Y-A-N. That's not the same thing. It's not the same reference. Arius, A-R-I-U-S, right?
Mm-hmm.
Arius, who had a different understanding. He still believed in the teachings of Christ, and servant leadership and love, but his interpretation was still seen as a threat to the church leaders, the church patriarchs of Rome. And as a result, they had to put an end to his interpretation.
But why do you think this is I think this is the crux of it. Why is that a threat? Why are women a threat? Why is peace and love a threat?
Yeah.
Why is spirituality and your own path to your own ascension a threat?
I was just trying to set the stage, but what is perceived of as the threat is coming, I would say, from a group of people who think that their understanding of the order of the world should remain, right? So anyone else who says, well, no, I don't think it's appropriate that women should be silenced or denied
mm-hmm.
the ability to speak and to teach spiritual things. It's not a woman's place. That, I would argue, is a reflection of a particular psyche particular mindset that to a large extent is an expression of the times and the culture. When people like the late great Senegalese Egyptologist and physicist, this man had a doctorate in three doctorates from the Sorbonne, Cheikh Anta Diop. But when he talked about how certain environments can produce a particular value system. So, and others would say the same thing. People like the late Michael Bradley, very controversial, but nevertheless, I think made a pretty good case when he talked about, again, environmental factors shaping values. If you have a society which emphasizes war, emphasizes conflict, emphasizes the taking of other resources, the tendency is to place greater emphasis upon physicality, physical strength, right? And physical strength, biologically speaking, physiologically speaking, is largely associated with those who are highest in testosterone, in the context, right, of what it is to be human, even in primates in general, but certainly in terms of Homo sapiens sapiens. So you have a culture that emphasizes war. Men are better equipped for physical combat in terms of carrying the weight of armor or carrying the weight of the sword, etc. So what I'm getting at is those societies, certainly in the case of Rome, which had as its founding principle the mythology or history, if you will, because many people interpret it as the history, although we will say mythology now, of Romulus and Remus, two twin boys having been raised by a she-wolf. Part of that was to instill this idea of, the strength, but also to some extent the brutality of a wolf in getting what it needs, right? You know, you have something I want, I physically take it. Mm-hmm. That mindset, that value system is cultural, right? Now, that then bumps up against or slams up against this new interpretation of Judaism. And I say new because we need to remember Jesus was Jewish, but his expression of Judaism didn't look like the Judaism of his time, which is why most Jewish communities would reject him and say he was not the Messiah. Mm-hmm. Jesus is emphasizing more love, more compassion that is seen to be universal and not as restricted just to the Jewish nation or the Jewish people. Mm-hmm. That didn't make a lot of sense to many people living in Judea and in what is, of course, today Israel and Palestine, given the context of their own history. Judaism had become very insular because they saw the abuse that they faced by so many other foreigners that came into the territory, including the Greeks. That's why you have things like the Maccabean Revolt. Again, just to reiterate, a culture that finds that it has to really fight and be very physical for the purpose of survival tends to diminish the value of the more nurturing aspects, you could say, the softer aspects of, say, femininity or that which is associated with being female, right? The nurturing aspects that if you talk to most traditional practitioners of African religions will say, it's understood that women, by virtue of giving birth, tend to have a greater compassion towards life because they know what it is to create it. They literally go through that process for 9 months of bringing life and knowing the value and the struggle and the potential threat of loss if that child doesn't make it, right? I mean, this is where the history then is overlapping with the anthropological and the psychological to try to understand, like I said, it's a great question. What is motivating people to do certain things? What's making them feel they have to control and dominate? Why can't they just say, look, you can have a different understanding of the Christ. I don't care. Right? Mm-hmm. Why did the Roman Catholic Church refer to the Gnostics as heretics and try to persecute and kill as many as possible? The Cathars and the Albigensians in France, same experience. The Cathars, who also created a society where men and women were seen as equals in the context of the priesthood, that was a no-no, right? So that community had to be controlled. And again, one reasonably should say, well, I don't understand. If the person's teaching love and community, but why
do they have to be controlled?
Exactly. Why do they have to be controlled? And certainly, why would you kill them? The contradiction is scathing. But it's a classic case of, you know, the religious assertion, right? I'm asserting that I am a follower of Christ. But that doesn't mean anything when you see the actions of the person are in direct opposition to the bait, what I like to call Christ 101, right? Leave it to that person and to, if you will, God Almighty to determine that person's destiny. Why are you trying to compel this conformity when, you know, the old saying, live and let live? I would say it really is a reflection of what some esoteric circles, including my own understanding in terms of moral science, when we speak of the higher self and the lower self, right? Mm-hmm. We are those two things strangely mixed. And the higher self is the mother of the virtues and the harmonies of life and breeds justice, mercy, love, and right. Every human being possesses that higher self, but every human being possesses the lower self. And the lower self is that which breeds theft, murder, right? Everything that harms.
Fear.
Fear, war, yeah. Right, war. So those sorts of interpretations of what it is to be human should supersede the dogmatic institutions around us that are expressions of their historical experiences. That's why I gave the example, like I said, of you know, what it was in the context of Rome. And like I said, Rome would be re-expressed ultimately in the Roman Catholic Church. And, you know, like I said, the same thing can be said for, any other religious expression in a particular country or nation at a particular point in time. The values of the country, the values of the nation can start to attach themselves, right, to the essential teachings. And if one is not careful, the values of the culture or country will become dominant over the values of the teachings. That's, for example, when I look at how could anybody calling themselves a Christian practice chattel slavery? And I'm very specific when I say chattel slavery, because chattel means to reduce to that of cattle. I know slavery's existed since antiquity, but if a Christian saying, do unto others as you would have others do unto you, is then going to participate in the practice of chattel slavery, Jesus is not in that at all.
I would argue it's probably, you know, that these prophets, Jesus, God, source energy is not in any of this. Whatever your belief system is, you know, Dr. Bay, you have shared with us some very deep insights into world religions, the psychology of humanity. And I think what I've come away with, or what has struck me from your eloquent speaking on this, and I'm so grateful to have you on the podcast,
thank you,
is that there is a deep-seated insecurity in the minds of men, that they would believe that they have to control people to follow them, that they have to kill them and threaten them, not with their earthly existence, but with their with their spiritual existence, in order to toe the line. And if it is true, if it is so true that the testosterone-laden physicality is where strength lies, why would you be so afraid of the divine feminine? Why would you be so afraid of her if you're so strong? And so I believe that there is a deep-seated insecurity and a knowing, a deep eternal knowing where the real power lies. And you said it. You said there's a higher self that we all possess that is feminine in nature, is in love, compassion.
That's right.
And then there's these lower energies. And that's these, I believe it is, there's this interplay. It comes down to me, this interplay of essence and form. This idea that as a testosterone-laden body, I realize I cannot create life. Truly, in this whole cosmic thing, I am disempowered in that ability. The supreme of all abilities is the ability to create, to bring forth life. And I recognize that if I cannot do that, then I'm going to use my brute force to try to suppress, oppress you, you that can do that, you that do have the power within you to create. But I think what is being missed in this agenda that is fear-driven in the lowest energies of existence, rooted in security, is that we are all creators. That there are types of creation. No, a masculine being cannot bring forth human life. Yet we all have the creator capacity within us of other things. But I think what is happening is this very heavy masculine energy ends up creating war, pain, suffering, fear-mongering. It's like, but we all can create from that higher expression of ourselves.
If I may, quick point in reference to what you said, and I love the way you're outlining this. I agree that this is definitely, to me, again, as a student both of history and psychology, there is this fear and the overemphasis upon the, if you want, and of course, I know hormonally we have all of it. We have the estrogen, progesterone, testosterone. But the idea that, and again, this is one of the psychological arguments, that many of these men felt they were losing control by virtue of what you just said, that, I mean, in fact, of course, you know, a man cannot bring forth life. He contributes, right? I mean, it's like the, you know, so much of religious mythology has Father Sky, Mother Earth, the rain representing the semen, the earth representing essentially the uterus of the womb and the two, the fertilization producing life. So there's always been this recognition of the balance. This goes back to what I said earlier about ancient Kemet and the balance. The idea, in fact, the term there is called ma'at, the idea of order, harmony, balance. So these were traditions that were understood, which is why Isis was so key in ancient Egyptian belief. But, and this perhaps is what we can, you know, if we get a chance to look at this again in another conversation, we reach a point, certainly in Western history, where there is an effort to diminish as much memory of the power of the divine feminine, even in the case of what was done to Mary Magdalene in Christianity, right? That's a classic example. And I also mentioned earlier the Cathar community. So those historical examples reveal communities where men and women or male and female were saying, we have to recognize both of us are spiritually empowered. In yes. harmony, we produce life. Mm-hmm. In harmony, we produce life, right? To try to emphasize, I'm better than you because I'm a male, is as dangerous, in my view, as saying I'm inherently better than you because I'm a female. Mm-hmm. The idea is the balance, that cosmic dance between those two spiritual forces, or the spiritual essence of who we are. And it's so funny because when I mentioned, you know, about the Moorish science understanding of saying the mother of the virtues and the harmonies of life, that's the higher self. Even the language is feminine. Mm-hmm. The mother of the virtues and the harmonies of life. To illustrate again that, and this is not just specific to my own spiritual system and my own religious understanding, because you can find this in many other world religions or spiritual, you know, expressions. But that, to me, that's, I just wanted to point that out.
Well, thank you so much for doing that. I have learned so much during this conversation. I sincerely hope that we can have another discussion on the religious constructs prevailing on Earth today. Dr. Bay, can you share with our audience who might want to learn more about you and your work, how they can reach you?
I can be contacted at the African and African American Studies Department at Berea College in Berea, Kentucky. We're online at berea.edu.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Bay. I want to thank you all for taking this inner journey with us today. And whether you are coming or going, looking inside or out, remember to be conscious. If you love this episode and if today's message resonated with you, please subscribe, rate, and review the Be Conscious podcast. I want to know what inspired you and what conscious topics you'd like to hear more about. And if you want, you can share those thoughts and questions with me at info@susannicholas.org.
Thanks for listening to the Be Conscious podcast with author, TEDx international speaker, and conscious coach, Dr. Susan Nicholas. Be sure to connect with her to stay up to date with her latest news and works. Learn more about her conscious speaking platform at susannicholas.org/speaking. Stay tuned for the next thought-provoking episode. And whether you are coming or going, looking inside or out, remember to be conscious.